Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, and welcome to The Conology, the podcast that dreams of the work of one of the world's greatest anime filmmakers, Satoshi Kon. I'm Michael Leader.
And I'm Steph Watts, and we've seen the lot of them.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and I'm in a bind.
So join us on our quest into the world of Satoshi Kon.
So, Michael, in much quicker fashion than when we covered Studio Ghibli, we've reached the end of our journey, in a way, on this mini-series about Satoshi Kon.
It's end of term once more, Jake. Let's get out the toys. Let's have a big party. So, yeah. This is Paprika, Satoshi Kon's, sadly, his last film that was released. And to many people, his most popular. It's either this or Perfect Blue seems to be the one that most people have heard of or seen. Steph, was this maybe the first one you saw?
No, the first one I saw was Perfect Blue. Mm-hmm. And then I'm trying to think when I actually watched this, probably in a weird jumble along with the rest of them, definitely right. Not in the order that we've been watching them now. But I think as we're going to get into, this is really benefits from watching it last after kind of seeing all of his other movies, and I think it really impacted me this time watching it that way.
It was such a wild card for me. This was one I saw many years ago and haven't rewatched in many years, and have, you know, as I've said on previous episodes, rewatched Millennium Actress, rewatched Tokyo Godfathers, Perfect Blue's always been a perennial favorite. So I was always maybe a little, you know, hesitant to go back to this one. I didn't know what I was going to find. When you're delving into your dreams, you never know what's going to come up. So I'm really excited to talk about this one. So I guess we should just start dreaming, right? As always, these films are very complex. In order to tackle them, we're going to have to go completely spoiler heavy. If that's something that you care about, you can go and watch the film. We'll still be here when you come back. This one is not as gnarly as some of the other ones, but there might be some very strange imagery that we discuss, so a bit of content warning there. But we will have a little bit of help from Steph up next with a bit of a synopsis.
When a machine that allows therapists to enter their patients' dreams to treat them is stolen, all hell breaks loose and Tokyo is taken over by a dream world. Only the red-haired dream detective, Paprika, can stop it.
So you two both just said there that you have never watched these films in order. This is very much a first-time adventure for all of us in that respect. And so what's been really nice throughout all of these episodes has been tracking the story of Satoshi Kon through his work and learning how he's got to all of these points in his career. And now we've kind of reached the last one, I suppose, or at least the last completed feature. Michael, what's happening between Paranoia Agent, the TV series, and Paprika?
Well, actually, as with Tokyo Godfathers and Paranoia Agent, Kon lines up this production to almost overlap with the end of Paranoia Agent. He's very much gearing up to start on it so he can dive straight into Paprika. Of course, though, let's have a bit of a flashback. We've been talking about Paprika a few times in these context sections. Of course, he wanted to adapt it into a feature straight after Perfect Blue, but the budget or the opportunity just didn't arise. Let's give a bit of context about Paprika first. So this is a novel written by Yasutaka Tsutsui, who anime fans may know. He also wrote The Girl Who Leapt Through Time, which was made into a film by Mamoru Hosoda, as well as it got adapted many times over the years. But he is a very influential, long-standing sci-fi fantasy writer in Japan, very influential on Satoshi Kon. And here's a quote that I found in Andrew Osman's book from Satoshi Kon about Paprika. "I read the novel when it was published and it made me want to incorporate the theme of dreams fusing with reality into my movies. So that's what I did with Perfect Blue and Millennium Actress. Now I've made the source of my inspiration into its own film. I've got some closure. I won't abandon this topic, but I feel like I've reached a certain goal." So he gets to this point now where almost the book inspired his style, and now he finally gets to adapt the book into a film that uses that style that was inspired by the book that he then perfected in other films. It's like a really interesting closed loop of a movie. Another interesting point that I found in the research here is that Paprika was serialized in the Japanese edition of Marie Claire magazine, the ladies mag. Interesting. But how did this project finally come to Kon? You've got this interesting back and forth where Satoshi Kon is dropping Tsutsui's names as an influence when he's making Perfect Blue, when he's making Millennium Actress. Then, on the other side, Tsutsui had seen Millennium Actress and became convinced that the guy who made that film is the only person with the imagination, visual imagination, strong enough to adapt Paprika. So they finally come together and say, let's work together, let's make this film together. He's been dubbed by the author as the only guy for the job. And Andrew Osmond puts it really well, using a quote from Kon saying it had to be destiny that Paprika would be made by him. Now, when it came to actually adapting the book, Kon sought to capture its spirit rather than do a faithful by the letter adaptation of the plot. And to do that, he worked again with Seishi Minakami, who he co-wrote Paranoia Agent with. And luckily, because Tsutsui had dubbed him the only man for the job, he was given free rein by the author. And then there's another quote in Andrew Osman's book where Tsutsui says, "If Kon didn't do as he pleased, I don't think the story would have taken advantage of the anime format. Regurgitating the novel is boring." That's a quote for us to use whenever anyone talks about radical adaptations, I guess. And perhaps fittingly, for a film that's so packed with dream imagery and dream logic, Kon started with the visuals they had in mind when approaching the adaptation and almost fitted the story around those ideas, visual ideas that he had. And he also started the storyboards before he'd finished the screenplay. He'd started sketching what the film would look like shot by shot before he'd even really know how it would end, which sounds a little bit like our pal Hayao Miyazaki, isn't it? We'd said before how Kon's films had been so well structured and neat, these tight, compact stories. And he said by this point he wanted to break out of that safe and tidy tendencies he'd had on previous films. So it results in a film that is a bit of a trip, and particularly once you get into the third act, it's quite hard to keep a handle on the plot, maybe. But it's better to think of it more as a trip into into the mind of Satoshi Kon, or as he describes it in a quote that Andrew Osmond also has, something of a roller coaster ride. And Kon says, "What's fun about a roller coaster is not that you understand the angles it turns or its rate of acceleration, but that it's fun and you enjoy it. And if you have a very odd, interesting, or curious dream, and you wake up a little dazed, then it makes you think about why you had such a dream." So he wanted to maintain the sense of a thrill ride, but then also a ride that did confuse you a little, so you'd maybe think on it a little more. Because if you have a too tidy an ending, you think, that's what this film was, that's what this film told me, the end. And I suppose that's been a theme throughout this whole podcast is, you know, there are so many ways to read these films, talk about these films, discuss these films, watch them over and over again. And Jake, I can't wait for you to rewatch some of them. I'd love to send that quote to Martin Scorsese and see what he thinks. Now, premiere. Differently to all the films we've discussed so far, Paprika sort of levels up in terms of its festival premiere. It premieres in September 2006 at the Venice Film Festival, you know, one of those big four or five film festivals throughout the year where the sort of the big art house films are premiered. So really, by this point, Con was graduating into the big leagues. And just to list a few of the films that also premiered that year, not saying that all these are great, but they're certainly these films that defined 2006 into 2007. You have The Queen, you have Children of Men, The Fountain, Darren Aronofsky, Zsa Zsangka's Still Life, which won the Golden Lion that year, Apichatpong, Whereas Ethical Syndromes in a Century, another film that people love from that era, David Lynch's Inland Empire. So he's almost now being put alongside many of the filmmakers we've said have influenced him over the years. And, you know, I shouldn't really miss the opportunity to say that also premiering, I think, out of competition at Venice that year was a little film by a guy called Miyazaki called Tales from Earthsea.
Oh, well, I wonder what Ursula Le Guin would have to say about that quote about regurgitating the novel is just boring.
I mean, unfortunately, we can't ring her up, but that's a really good question, Jake. So the film comes out in Japan later in 2006, and then in 2007 has a theatrical release in the States and a DVD release in the UK. So because of that, it has like a whole wave of reviews. You can go on Rotten Tomatoes. It has a really strong, fresh rating, but also reviews from all the major outlets really praising this film. I mean, some of them having maybe a little bit of snobby tendency, saying that this is elevating beyond anime. It's not your usual anime. It's full of thoughts and visual imagination. Like, clearly they've not watched much anime, but it's really great to see critics of the caliber of The New Yorker, Deo Denby, or Manola Dargis, you know, really tussling with this sort of film and coming out positively. I should mention, I love the tagline for the US release of this film. I think it's simultaneously the best tagline, but also the most cringeworthy one possible. And it's, "This is your brain on anime."
That is awful.
It's awful. It's referring to the 80s anti-drugs campaign, "This is your brain on drugs," I guess, but it's also so dated and of its time. You can imagine that being a very post-Matrix kind of tagline. I'd love to be in the room when the miniature Don Draper pitched that tagline at Sony.
This is like if Gaspar Noé was like, "Guys, I've got a new tagline for my film." Here it is.
Oh yeah, absolutely. The next Gaspar Noé is gonna be, "This is your brain on Noé."
But if you think back to our Tale of Princess Kaguya episode, which was the last time we covered the last film by a filmmaker before they died, in the context I sort of told the rest of the story. Of course, there is a story after Paprika for Satoshi Kon, but I think we'll cover that in our next episode, which is our wrap-up mailbag tribute episode. Because for now, Steph and Jake, I want to hear about what your brains were like on Paprika.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So, Jake, we've started every review section, I think, with talking about the opening of each film. And this one also feels like a great opportunity to do that. So I guess let's dive in from the very start. And what do we kind of recognise from the earlier work of Satoshi Kon's that we've seen so far? What seems different?
Yeah.
What's going on?
So as with all of these, he makes it very evident that we're watching a Satoshi Kon film, and this more than any other before it, I think. And because of the dreamlike nature of the narrative, I suppose we are more forgiving for when someone might want to bend the creativity to themselves. And although we've picked up on stylistic hangovers from his previous works, whether that's in the design or in the edit or in the nature of the storytelling, here we're actually seeing, I think, direct references to his other works prior to this. We have an opening scene with a magician who says it's the greatest showtime, and I was ready for him to whip his cane down, and I was already going, sadly, I know Satoshi Kon has predicted a lot of the future, but he could not predict The Greatest Showman. So that sadly didn't happen. But of course, this was a performance within a dream, and that dream gets ripped back into reality. And we see that this is all being controlled or dictated by Paprika within the mind of this detective. And then we go into these opening titles, and this is where I suddenly start seeing these things, that not only are we seeing this storytelling that's familiar, we're seeing these images that are familiar. And so from Perfect Blue, we've got these mirror shots and this kind of skipping light dance through town that Paprika does as if no one else is taking any notice of her. From Paranoia Agent, we've got the blurring of traffic going in front of her. From Millennium Actress, you've got this montage of films that the detective's dream clashes through. From Tokyo Godfathers, for me at least, Miyuki looks incredibly like Paprika if you took her hat off. They've got same hair, same eyes. And then we've got these in-world titles. And so all of this is happening within the first 5 minutes of it. And more so than any of the others, I suppose, this is so recognizably a Satoshi Kon film.
It's really incredible. I think that I've probably said this on every episode so far, but the opening 15-20 minutes of this film is just some of the best filmmaking in my mind. The sense of being lured into this world, not knowing where it's going to go, whether you're in a dream, whether you're in reality, the visual imagination here on display, the first time you see that corridor shot, the first time you see someone falling through a dream into waking is astonishing. But I love so much of that opening scene, well, the scene of Paprika going through town, and she's moving from person to person, from screen to screen, and popping up and just touching all these lives in little ways. When she puts the jacket over the sleeping guy working late in the office, asleep at his computer. You mentioned how it's very similar to the opening titles for Paranoia Agent, where she's standing at the crossroads and the traffic is flowing all around her. The sort of amazing, I'm going to go galaxy brain a few times at this point, but the fact that she stops the traffic already shows you that you're in a different world to Paranoia Agent, which looked at the city, looked at the modern world as something potentially toxic, potentially a source of anguish and anxiety. Maybe it's the music, maybe it's her outlook, maybe it's the way that she's animated and voiced, but Paprika is in control of that. She stops the traffic around her, whereas in the Paranoia Agent opening titles, they were being subsumed by that. And already you're on this pathway, you're thinking, this is taking on board everything about Paranoia Agent stylistically, the world around her, the visual imagination, but maybe it's a little bit more optimistic.
Yeah, I think so. Compared to Perfect Blue, we're seeing an inner personality in Paprika that is cooperative, that wants to help. And we're seeing someone who exists through screen media a lot of the time, through adverts, and using those adverts to again assist and drive the plot in a positive way. And we're not trying to kind of break and fragment a person like we might in Paranoia Agent or in Perfect Blue. We're actually trying to support that. And although we're getting all of these stylistic things that we absolutely recognize from all of those other works, tonally, this feels like he's gone in a more positive direction.
Yeah, it's surprising how different that kind of phantom figure skipping through the streets, how different that can be with a change in surrounding and a slight change in music, like where it's really creepy and unsettling in Perfect Blue. It's actually really uplifting and kind of freeing in this, in the opening.
Yeah, and I think that we might imagine that this, with that tagline of this is your brain on anime, and that it's going to be about getting inside people's dreams, and that it's from the mind of the guy that made Perfect Blue, that this is all going to be quite nightmarish stuff, and it's going to be absolutely getting in and twisting your melon. And although it does do that, it's not as scary as I anticipated it to be. There is like horrible imagery at points, like pushing your hand inside someone's body and breaking them apart and stuff like that. But I suppose I was expecting more in the Darren Aronofsky world, and it's more like a Jodorowsky.
I like the rhyming you've brought in there, Jake. I love how we're still talking in terms of Western feature filmmaking, and that's completely there, as you said, in this opening. And we should take a quick moment to talk about cinema in this. Of course, where Paprika is having her therapy sessions with the detective is in a cinema. You have that amazing fake out where she's applauding a cinema screen on which his dream is happening. It's then threaded through his whole story. Again, we have a detective who has to go deep within himself and come to some sort of moment of clarity in order to crack the case, like with Paranoia Agent. But I love how, whereas we said in our Millennium Actress episode that he was creating this tapestry that was a tribute to Japanese cinema, and he felt himself in interviews that he had to learn about that. Japanese cinema wasn't necessarily his home base. I feel in this one he's throwing a lot of maybe references that are closer to him on screen. You have, you know, just you mentioned the quick montage of in the detective's dream that we keep going back to. We have The Greatest Show on Earth, the big circus epic from the Golden Age of Hollywood. You have Roman Holiday. You have a scene that's never explicitly said that it's a James Bond scene, but it's a scene from Russia with Love where he's being garroted on the train. All these references just being thrown at the screen, plus of course that the scene where the detective slips into being for a moment either Akira Kurosawa or cosplaying as Akira Kurosawa with the hat and glasses, talking about the 180 degree line of cutting, which I know you love, Jake, whenever a film becomes a little bit of a cinema essay, cinema history.
Yeah,
lesson.
And deploying a proper Microsoft PowerPoint 2004 transition at that point as well to flip the screen around.
That moment makes me think of Fight Club and the way that David Fincher would stop the action of the narrative, and you'd have Brad Pitt, whoever it is at that point, Ed Norton or Brad Pitt, explaining the cigarette burn in the top corner of the screen. And it would be done in these overlay graphics, a little bit of film trivia, little tidbits to take home with you.
Yeah, well, I think that's our second mention of David Fincher as well. In Paranoia Agent, that we spoke about those into title cards feeling very much of that 90s Fincher feel.
Yeah, and with the 180 degree line, it actually breaks that line way before it's actually explained. I think it's when the older guy is kind of descending into this dream rant, there's a shot that breaks that line, and where you're a bit kind of like, oh, hang on, what's happened there? That was a weird cut. And then it's kind of explained later. I just really love that it's kind of doing that and then talking about it as well. And I think it really has a lot of love for cinema and like Con's love for cinema coming through. Especially that moment where the detective kind of pushes his face through the actual cinema screen is like a reverse of that kind of famous story of people going to watch a train on the screen in the cinema and then getting scared because they thought it was gonna come through the screen. It's like the reverse of that. That'll yeah. be me when I go back to the cinema eventually, just pushing my face through the screen.
Well, that moment and a number of other moments involving screens certainly made me thought that I wonder if he had been watching Videodrome before this as well, because that famous image of the screen coming out and grabbing you and pulling you into it, which like Cronenberg uses in a very much a horror manifestation, here it's like the warm embrace that cinema can give you.
that sequence with the 180 degree line took me all the way back to reading Bordwell and Thompson's film art introduction, which is like the key text that you read at university. And that in their section on the 180 degree line, they have David Lynch saying, you can do whatever you want in cinema, but never break that line. And I love that David Lynch wouldn't dare break it, but Con would. And he'll tell you he's doing it while he's doing it. It's almost like it's a overworked expression, but he's like a jazz musician showing you the melody and then warping it at the same time. But of course, we've now mentioned Cronenberg, Aronofsky, Fincher, Lynch. I mean, I suppose the big Hollywood name we've not mentioned so far in the review is little Chrissy, Christopher Nolan, yes. with his large formats and his big ideas. People say that Inception ripped off this film. I know, Jake, as a newcomer, and that's all you knew about this film, do you think that's a fair allegation to make?
I was really expecting it to be a lot heavier in the rip-off quality, the way that people talk about it. And I just think that Satoshi Kon and Christopher Nolan were interested in a mechanism that would allow you to get inside people's dreams. That was the thing they were interested in. And the way that they use that is entirely different. And I'm sure prior to this, you could find examples of the idea of getting inside people's dreams. But it's because I think when the dialogue is there as a subtitle in front of you, and you see a line like, the dream was projected into his subconscious without him knowing. If you're a big fan of Paprika and 4 years later you go and watch Inception, you're going to think, what a glaring ripoff. But other than that bit of tech, the DC Mini, that allows the process to start, beyond that, like, Nolan's got 2.5 hours and is doing something entirely different with what he's doing with his 90 minutes. Because Satoshi Kon is actually interested in the dream. He's interested in what we know as dreams and dream logic and visuals. And the plot is beside the point. Whereas Christopher Nolan is interested in making a big heist film. And when you think about it, the dreams within Inception aren't actually that imaginative. It's a city or a fortress or a beach or a building. They're not totally wild spaces. And I know he got Ellen Page to draw a map and say that that's why this is a dream fortress or something, but it could be any other building. Whereas the landscape in Paprika is absolutely not anything that could be described as plain or boring.
When Christopher Nolan makes a frog parade, the frogs playing clarinets, that's when we know he's truly ripping off the film. But yeah, I agree. And I think that kind of, I think Con captures so well just that state of like falling into a dream and just the logic, like as you're falling asleep, you'll be thinking of something and then suddenly you'll just kind of go off track because you like because you're falling asleep. And I think he captures that slip from reality into dreams so well in this, whereas in Inception it's very kind of, you know, when you've transferred to the dream.
Oh yeah, and everyone within Inception is extremely alert and are very aware of how all the landscape works around them and how they can interact with this. And that's not how a dream would work. It can bend and flex all the time, and just around you as the dreamer. And that's what I found so exciting about watching Paprika. And I will get into the plot, but I kind of left that aside after about 20 minutes and very happily just, as you say, Steph, just kind of let myself into it and just embrace it.
I think the other, you quoted that line, Jake, which is basically the whole point of that is basically an inception, isn't it? Planting a dream into someone's consciousness. The other sequence that people point to as being similar to Inception is that corridor scene. And I think it completely shows up the different approaches to dreams that Nolan and Conn have, that the reason why Joseph Gordon-Levitt is running on walls in that corridor scene is because they're in a car in the dream above them that is flying off its wheels, and that's destabilizing the dream in a gravity sense. Whereas what destabilizes dreams in Conn's view is psychology. It's the actual mystery of our own identities. And that's what, I mean, this isn't the Inception podcast. It's not a Nolanology. But that's what disappoints me about Inception, and that's what completely intrigues me about Paprika. The fact that also I fell off my sofa, so I need to mention this, that the DC Mini is talked about as the key to the mystery of dreams. So there's another key coming back. Conn likes coming back to those, as we mentioned with Millennium Actress. And also Tokyo Godfathers starts with a key.
But then if we can say that, as we've said, like the key in any of these things doesn't actually matter. Mm-hmm. And if the key in this is the thing that allows us to enter dreams, that is him saying, doesn't matter. Just, this is what I want to do. Just let yourself enter these dreams for 90 minutes and get out again. And that's what he wants to do with it.
And he also, even in a film like this, which is so rooted in a dream world, will throw in a casual couple of lines of dialogue that show that he's ahead of everybody in terms of his social commentary, where there's a comparison between dreams and the internet, which is where the unfiltered, unconscious mind is allowed to vent, which is exactly what Twitter is, I guess. And this was released years before the popularization of Twitter.
Yeah, and those two guys that are within the internet that also allow someone to access the shared dream space. I did for a moment think, so the DC Mini lets some people enter dreams, but also if you literally just go onto this website, you can also do the same thing. And then I thought, I'm questioning this too much. And maybe a few watches down the line, I would get how maybe that does actually make sense and all of this does come together. But you two, having now watched this multiple times, do you feel like the plot is there? And if it is that needed?
Well, I feel like, yeah, you start off with that kind of, the DC Mini has been stolen. We need to get it back. What's the, like, who are we chasing, who is the culprit type thing. That goes on for a little bit and it's kind of spread out, but then I guess what we're returning to, as we were with Millennium Actress, is this kind of exploration of memory and cinema and that kind of chasing of something that you can't quite reach, and yeah, that kind of link between dreams and cinema and I guess the internet as well, that it just feels like, yeah, you kind of start with this plot, you start with the key, and then it just kind of spirals out into ideas that Conn's having and wants to like get into in the film.
I wonder if that comes from his coming straight off of Paranoia Agent, which as we mentioned in our episode, starts with about 3 or 4 episodes that set you up for what the procedural is and what the plot actually is. And then it just veers off for the remainder of it. And then in the last 10 minutes of the last episode tells you, oh no, here's actually what happened, and tries to make some sense of it. And it's in that veering off that we said in Paranoia Agent, that's where we had the most fun and that's where he has the most fun. And you get that in that, in the bulk of Paprika, when he's really just letting loose. And it's so thrilling to watch.
Yeah, and it feels like as well, I'm really glad that we watched Paranoia Agent in this series, because this does have so many connections to it. And it feels like he has like some of the ideas in Paranoia Agent. We talked about on that episode, that series being this kind of drawer of ideas that he was kind of dipping into. And then some of these things, like I guess the detective and the kind of unsolved case, Paprika is a kind of split personality. They feel like these ideas that he's had and he's done in a kind of 20-minute TV episode, but he's kind of digging into more now. So that was really great to see those things coming back all the way through everything we've watched.
I really hope that the context for this episode and the previous episodes all feed into explaining a little bit of why Paprika is the way that it is. So with Paranoia Agent, he saw the elongated multi-episode format as an experiment in storytelling and jumping between protagonists and just having a deep dive in one story per episode, or doing a complete experimentation in one episode. But of course, he wasn't storyboarding all of that. And Paprika, he wanted to storyboard that himself before writing it, before fully writing it. So if storytelling and experimenting within his storytelling voice was the impulse behind Paranoia Agent, for Paprika, it's his visual imagination that he wants to explore. And this is, gosh, packed full of so many visual moments. But also, I suppose, in terms of the question of, do we care about the plot? Do we really, once all these resolutions come towards the back end, you know, the romance between the, Atchan and her colleague, or the way that the actual conflict resolves, do we care by that point, and are we instead going along with the roller coaster ride? Andrew, I think in his book, Andrew Osmond alleges that, you know, some of those resolutions were sort of done on the fly. That he was working out the ending as he was writing it. And that's almost a little bit, that harks back to some of our Ghibli episodes, I suppose, and why some of Miyazaki's endings seem so pat or too convenient or out of nowhere. But all that does is shows that he's really indulging and experimenting and flexing his muscles visually. And there are so many moments that come to mind in this film, maybe more within this one film than in everything we've done so far, just visual moments that resonate. I wonder whether we could highlight a couple.
Yeah, it's quite funny when you, if you are searching for a GIF online and you type in Satoshi Kon, the top 5 of those are probably going to be 1 of looking through the window in Perfect Blue, and then the rest are going to be from this, because it's so good at just being able to condense an impactful moment into that single frame. So Steph, you're a big frog fan. I'm sure that there's a recurring frame in this that you're a big fan of.
Frog parade. I think, yeah, we mentioned earlier, but yeah, such a great image. I hope my dreams are like that. Just lots of frogs playing instruments. But yeah, that kind of dream parade sequence as just an image of kind of all of this stuff from your subconscious coming together, especially all of the little porcelain dolls kind of saluting, are really creepy and really kind of stick with you. And that imagery coming back later in the film as well, there's some really good kind of visual motifs that he's playing on throughout.
Yeah, I mean, for me, there's stuff like I mentioned already the hand penetrating the body and then ripping all the way through it and then out through the face, and the shell within Paprika. I think that's brilliant. I think there's that the giant porcelain doll's face appearing across the glass walkway. The lads on the top of the roof, just like synchronized swimmers falling off the edge of it. So much of this is so memorable. And I think it's incredibly rare for a director to get away with a film where they have put this first, put their visual first, and for critics to come out of it and think, yep, that's fine. We're okay with that. And that, I think that goes to show just how arresting his craft of imagery is.
Yeah, the ones that jump out for me, I mean, the hand sequences, that's Cronenberg body horror, isn't it? We're having a hand push through your body, but then still, you know, make an impression all the way through. But also the way that it is seen as skeezy Rongan pulling the paprika out of Atco. It really kind of violent imagery without showing the violence that we've seen in previous ones. It's purely dream logic violence. I also love probably the most complex moment in the film, which is when they're trying to describe how the delusion, the core Frog Parade delusion, is starting to glom onto all these other dreams and, you know, consciousness that's going out in the world and is bringing the real world into it. They talk about how, you know, all of these multiple dream streams come together, and he just zooms in on a windscreen in the rain as they're driving, and you see multiple paths of raindrops coming together into one long torrent of rain. And that's just a really nice, simple visual explanation of what's going on that gets beyond the actual mechanics, the hard sci-fi of what's actually going on here, which I imagine is how Christopher Nolan would have tried to do it. Go and watch Interstellar to see how he tries to turn, you know, schematize something unknowable and explainable. But that shows that Khan is still innovating at every visual level all the way through, and it's just amazing.
It's such a good example of that kind of show don't tell style of filmmaking, and just that, yeah, you can have that kind of the raindrops on the window, or you can have Paprika being kind of opened up to reveal Atsuko inside. Like, instead of telling us like what that means, you can just look at it and you can know like what is going on there with the kind of the split between those two characters and stuff like that. Is it's really kind of economic, mm-hmm. And like really powerful in just using those visuals, instead of just kind of giving us loads and loads of words to explain what he's trying to convey.
And the way that he uses media, and the way he understands the 21st century mind, the way that we can flip, we can almost use screens as a way to instantaneously transport ourselves from one place to another. That's literally what Paprika does. In that massive dream sequence at the end, when they jump into the TV to come out of the camera filming the shots on the other side, or she jumps into a billboard and comes off another advert elsewhere, it just shows how time and space has just been collapsed in on itself by the modern cacophony, but it's done as a way that we can control it. We can use it to our advantage rather than Paranoia Agent, which saw it as a source of anguish. So we hadn't watched these films chronologically before, and when we finally got to The Wind Rises and Princess Kaguya, we saw all of these echoes in their previous films, and that's what we see here. And we should talk about where it ends, where Paprika and the detective have their final meeting. A multiplex showing Khan's films.
I think this ending is wonderful. And you considering it is his last film, or last feature film, it is just stunning that he ends this way. And obviously he doesn't know what's going to happen to him, but it feels like he does, and it's surprisingly gentle considering everything that's come before it. You've got this setup of this mega kaiju fight that's going to destroy the city, but it that goes off in a way that you're really not expecting it to. And maybe it's because none of us have been to the cinema in 6 months, but the prospect of getting through all of this horribleness in this life that he's gone through, and that at the end of it he can let all of that go, he's got through all of that, and finally he can go to the cinema. I got a little teary at that prospect.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think even though I guess he's kind of teasing his next project with the Dreaming Kids dream machine, which he never finished, this does feel like a really definite conclusion, at least to the ideas that he's been working through all through kind of Perfect Blue, Millennium Actress, and Paranoia Agent, at least. And it's such a good kind of closing the loop on all of that kind of exploration of dream and memory, and how kind of cinema relates to that and how that can be actually portrayed through film. It's, yeah, a really surprisingly final conclusion.
And what a flex, really, to end your film with go to the cinema, maybe to see my movies. If that's really, I mean, that's one more cynical way of looking at it, but maybe it's because we've found such a searching human quality through all his films developing and through Paranoia Agent that we're able to see that as just, it's all about cinema. Cinema is the realm of dreams. And that's why we go to, well, that's why we look at cinema. It's going all the way back to Millennium Actress, that, you know, what happens between us as the spectator, the camera that's recording, but then also the projector that's projecting onto the screen, is this magic where we create this shared consciousness, this shared memory, and that is something that needs to be celebrated.
So, in a way, does that make Paprika, the character, an embodiment of cinema? Because she is the one who allows us to transport into them. And so it's so optimistic and so positive because it is him crafting this narrative about the value that cinema has.
So, yeah, so cinema and everything that Paprika represents is that little spice. I mean, that's actually a line in there, isn't it? That's what she brings, a little added spice to our life, which ends, you know, it is the flip of Paranoia Agent in many ways, and that's that resolving in that way seems so appropriate. And going back to the quote that I started the context with, he saw this as finally telling the story he almost always wanted to tell, or finally closing the loop on the style of filmmaking that he almost worked through in order to adapt the novel that inspired him in the first place.
Okay, Michael, so I mean, we've kind of got quite surprisingly emotional there about the final few moments of this and how this perfectly closes the loop on all of his films and how this is the perfect Satoshi Kon moment. But considering all of that, how does it slot into the rest of his work in your ranking of them? Let's move on to the popularity contest.
So I think I've almost ranked these in different orders for every episode. I haven't actually double checked every time because they're all so close in my estimations, and rewatching them has almost just cemented them as being almost on a par with one another. But Steph, as the other person going into this with, you know, pre-baked opinions on Kon, what's your final ranking, if you can even do that?
Oh, yeah, because I think last week we got into what episodes of Paranoia Agent would you rank as well. So we'll try not to do that again. But yeah, I think this one has definitely gone up in my estimations from the last time I watched it, just from that benefit of seeing this kind of seeing Kon working through these ideas and that culmination in this film. So I guess it would have to be kind of top tier. I mean, they're really not ranked because I like all of them. They're not kind of ranked as in the last one is bad, but I guess, I mean, Perfect Blue is still up there as I think the favorite. But then maybe, yeah, Paprika and Paranoia Agent coming in close second. And then I think I had Tokyo Godfathers and then Millennium Actress. But yeah, I mean, looking back, this one kind of raises those other ones up as well in the context of seeing this. So yeah, and maybe that'll change in like a month as well once I've like sat with it for longer. But I think that's my final ranking.
It's just so hard. So this was always my least favorite. Probably because, you know, I was young and I didn't like the fact that it was the most popular one. I'm sorry, I'll put my hand up. I was such a gatekeeper-y con hipster at one point. But watching it as we just have gives it such power. But does that mean that it's only good when watched in context? Is a big question. But also, as we said when we set out, the reason why I chose Satoshi Kon is that he never made a bad film, and his TV series is excellent as well. So it's almost arbitrary to put them in order for me. But Perfect Blue is up top. I think I would still put Paranoia Agent second, maybe Millennium Actress, Paprika, Tokyo Godfathers. But that's with the understanding that really they're all 4-star and above films. There isn't a bad one in the bunch. But really the most important opinion on this is yours, Jake, as the complete newcomer.
Yes, but I don't know how valuable that is, because I think compared to other films that we've covered on this podcast, these ones merit the multiple watch so much more. The more we do this, the more I think a redux of this entire series in a year's time could have value. I am sticking with where I was last week. I think Paranoia Agent is still my favorite. And I think that's a key word, like favorite there, because it manages to be so impressive but so enjoyable at the same time. And maybe that's why I just put it very slightly above Perfect Blue. And Perfect Blue has so much power for me because it was obviously the first one, and nothing can ever take that away. And I think I'd slot in Paprika just underneath those two. And then Millennium Actress and Tokyo Godfathers. And as you say, Michael, they're all very good. And I will very happily go back and do these all again.
Can we definitively say best soundtrack?
Paprika. Paprika's the soundtrack that definitely feels most in line with the film itself.
What do you think, Steph?
I just can never get that right out of my head. So, I mean, that's my favourite. But this soundtrack, when it properly kicks in, it's so good and it works so well. And, yeah, you have that kind of weirdness of Susumu Hirasawa being on, like, Millennium Actress. But then it really works in this one, and it really kind of raises it up.
And it's on Spotify. It's the only Hirasawa album on Spotify, I think, so we can crank up the parade every day. Those wonderful Vocaloid sounds.
Michael, now that you're no longer an anime gatekeeper, and you've watched all of these in order, have you changed your feelings towards Kon at all? Has a new director formed in your mind?
Maybe not. When we started this series, or at least when we talked about doing this series, we chose Satoshi Kon because all of his films are great and he has the international renown and standing of a Miyazaki or a Takahata. So we could use the format that we've developed with Ghibli Attack and approach it for a chronology. I didn't really, until we watched them all side by side, realise that they all built towards this grand arc of a narrative. Stylistically, in terms of his experimentation, in terms of his filmmaking vision, I didn't realize that we were actually telling a story all the way through, watching as a bystander, as a filmmaker, you know, expanding the horizons of their style with every film. I always saw these films as four individual films that worked incredibly well on their own merits, because that's probably how I saw them. But if there's anything like a final statement on these films and Paranoia Agent that we've watched, is that while he was making something original every time, he was still building towards something. And that body of work exists as a great masterpiece, as opposed to it being five-star works in their own right. That's his contribution to anime. The whole thing. The whole damn thing.
But that's not the end of our full chronology. We've still got one more episode to go.
We do. And since we've been dropping these episodes across July and into August, we have to mark the fact that it's ending around the 10th anniversary of Satoshi Kon's, you know, very sad young death. So this final episode is our opportunity to open up the conversation. We've been calling it a mailbag episode all the way through, because really we are just three separate opinions out of the whole mass unconscious delusional mind of cinema. And we'd love to hear from listeners about Satoshi Kon, your favorites, what he means to you, what the individual films mean to you. But also we do have a little bit of roundup to do. There's the couple of years after Paprika where he was still working. He made a short film. He made a good chunk of his next movie. We should talk about that. He made books that we may have something to talk about. So we do have unfinished business with Satoshi Kon that we'll cover next week in our mailbag tribute special.
And if you want to keep up with us until then, you can email all of your Satoshi Kon thoughts to ghibli@little.studios.com, or keep up with us on Twitter @GhibliOtech, and Michael's over there @MichaelJLeader.
And you can follow Steph @_StephWatts.
And you can follow Jake @JakeHCunningham. Ghibliotech is a Little Dot Studios production. Our music is made by Anthony Ng, our artwork is by Sophie Moe, and Jamie Maisner is our audio wizard. The show is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, Steph Watts, and Harold McShiel. Hi everyone, thank you for sticking through the credits. Now, Megumi Hayashibara, the voice of Atsuko and Paprika, is a huge voice actor in anime. She played Rei in Neon Genesis Evangelion, she's in Pokemon, she's in Cowboy Bebop, and so many more. But she actually began her voice acting career back in 1986 doing extra voices on Castle in the Sky.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for ways to win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.